Welcome to CoreCast, a production of National Community Renaissance, a nonprofit affordable housing developer dedicated to solving the housing challenges facing seniors, veterans, and low-income families in America. CoreCast is designed to expand interest in the area of affordable housing, as well as interview problem solvers and explore solutions to our housing challenges. Welcome into the National Core Studios for this edition of CoreCast. I'm your host, Jonathan Kendrick, and joined, as always, by National Core's President and CEO, Steve Pontell. Steve, thanks for being here with us today.
Certainly. Good to see you, Jonathan.
You as well, and we have a great show for the listeners ahead. We have renowned economist and author Joel Kotkin, who recently authored a report for us at National Core titled The Cost of Not Housing. Joel will be joining us a little bit later in the show to discuss the findings of that paper, as well as his new book, The Human City. We'll also have Michael Novogratz come on and do his Tax Credit Tuesday updates, some legislative highlights from the world of affordable housing. But before we get into that, we always start our show with the water cooler section as we discuss some of the recent trends in the world of housing. And today we're going to discuss an event that we had earlier this month at the historic Mission Inn in Riverside, California. It was the fourth symposium on the affordability of housing that National Core has put together with a series of partners that we'll mention in a second, and we'll discuss a little bit of National Core's thinking that went into that. And Steve, wanted to start off with kind of an overview of this symposium structure that we've seen, these events that National Core has been hosting. This was the fourth now. There's been three across Southern California and Riverside County, San Bernardino County, and Los Angeles County, as well as one back in Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill. And what was the thinking behind starting these symposium discussions, and how have you seen them evolve over the years?
Sure. Thank you, Jonathan. You know, the challenge we have is the different segment. One of the challenges we have is different segments of housing have not historically communicated or coordinated very well. And so the opportunity to bring together multifamily and single family, homeownership and rental into a conversation about how to deal with the challenges associated with having an adequate supply of housing seemed to make a lot of sense. And then the other concept that we've really struggled is to not just bring housing people together, but to bring people that are affected by housing. So the relationship between health and housing, education and housing, the relationship between law enforcement and housing, you know, retail, commercial activities and housing, to begin to understand the crucial, fundamental, foundational role housing plays in a successful community. And so it's our hope through these symposiums that we've broadened the conversation and increased awareness and knowledge about how housing fits and how important it is.
And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that coalition or the partnership that is begun to assemble around housing locally here in the Inland Empire and hopefully in other areas as well. We've had the Inland Valleys Association of Realtors, the California Apartment Association's Greater Inland Empire chapter, two of the local Building Industry Association chapters. This year we were happy to welcome the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco as a partner as well. The Housing Authority of the County of San Bernardino, Raymond James Financial, was a sponsor on this as well. So, you know, we have the realtors, the apartment owners, the builders, the lenders, the banks, all of these. How does that discussion, as well as us as an affordable housing developer and public housing, how does that kind of change the conversation that we often see in many localities around housing?
Right. It goes to the point that, you know, that what we call silos are incredibly rational. And so historically, people that build apartments get together with people that build apartments, and people that build single-family homes get together with people that build single-family homes, and people that sell real estate talk to people that sell real estate. And so the opportunity to broaden the perspective, because the thing about housing is different housing needs are met at different life stages in different ways. And so when you're young, single, you have a particular type of housing that would meet your need. Once you're married, it's a different type. When you have children, it's a different type. When you're empty nesters, it's a different type. You know, when you retire, it's a different type. And so trying to put together that entire continuum of housing, and in a conversation with all of the different aspects of it, it seems to be the best way to move forward the agenda of the production of housing. And from a national core perspective, where our job is affordable housing, we're not just focused on subsidized housing, we're focused on the affordability of housing. Because ultimately, unless the market can supply housing that people can afford, we're never going to accomplish having housing that's affordable. And so that's a big part of our mission and something that we're investing a lot of energy in.
And that's exactly a great segue into the housing principles that were adopted by this coalition and circulated as part of these symposium events. And we're going to go through some of these just to describe kind of the thinking behind these different organizations on the importance of housing. So the first principle is housing is essential to a healthy, thriving community. And number two is one that Steve, you were just discussing right now. Equally important is a range of housing that provides for people from all walks of life and in all life stages. And I wanted to get your thoughts here on the third one. Poorly conceived policies and regulations threaten the ability to meet housing demands. What does that look like in communities?
Well, and you know, just to set the stage back at the first principle, this is not complicated. This is about people. And if you think of the two basic needs, it's food and shelter. I mean, so at the end of the day, what we're talking about is a very basic human need. And to the extent we can start with, why do we care about this? It's because people matter. You know, why are we focusing on this? Because people matter. And so when you think about policies that are adopted, are they contributing to the production of housing that people can afford, or are they getting in the way of it? Are they creating other priorities for communities? And so the easiest example is we currently have policies that drive the fiscal structure of local government, which gives a high premium on retail because cities are benefited by the sales tax that are generated at retail stores. And for cities to play the cards they're dealt is the totally logical thing. They pursue retail aggressively, whereas they perceive housing to be a net cost. And so housing ends up having to pay all the costs and hurdles and challenges of getting developed and is not necessarily in, you know, cities aren't necessarily pursuing housing construction the way they would pursue an auto dealership trying to come into their city. And so those are the kinds of policies which what are we incenting cities to do versus what are the things we're creating obstacles for? And the manifestation of that is we have an oversupply of retail. We have more retail than we will ever use, and increasingly lower and lower quality of retail, shopping centers and strip centers, et cetera, whereas we have a shortage of housing. And so whenever you have a surplus of something, you're over-incenting it. When you have a shortage of something, the barriers are too high. And so that's what that third policy primarily addresses.
And it goes on to state that inadequate housing supplies lead to overcrowding and the long-term deterioration of communities. Roads, water, sewer, schools, parks, and police, and fire are all overtaxed in that sense. And then the fifth one here is interesting in that this is something we often discuss on CoreCast as we bring in experts from a variety of fields. And this one states, adequate housing is a proven social determinant of health, education outcomes, violent crime reduction, and social service demand. And Steve, it seems like that is starting to pick up some traction in the community as we hear people that are involved in education and involved in health starting to point to housing as a key factor in reducing some of these negative aspects.
Absolutely. And I think having the City of San Bernardino Police Chief participate in our last housing symposium is an example of the recognition of the critical role having adequate housing, having quality housing plays to the security and safety of a community. And the police chief is very articulate about the need for housing and the need for the management and maintenance of housing in order for a city to be successful. And you can see on the health side, LA County's efforts out of their public health department to create a housing authority within their public health department because they see the savings associated with people being adequately housed versus in the extreme living on the streets, demanding social services, the highest price point. They're saving $34,000 per housed person. And so ultimately, it's in everybody's best interest to understand the role and the benefit of investing in housing.
This next point was one that this symposium was really based on, the cost of not housing. especially for local governments. An adequate supply of housing generates more revenue than an undersupply. Therefore, housing is a net gain to local government, not a net cost, as often believed. People demand services, houses do not. People come whether or not you have adequate housing or not. And there's been some examples, I believe, in Santa Ana on this one in the past of you know, housing was not built and yet people continued to come, and that's a myth that is out there.
Right, and what ends up happening is you end up with a city like Santa Ana that has one of the highest per capita per room densities in the entire country, and the county of Los Angeles has the highest density of any urban area with regard to the per capita per room density, not by design. So the people are there, and if we do not provide shelter for people, they will find shelter. And more often than not, to quote Greg Devereaux, it's shelter we're not going to want them to have, whether it's living in cars or campers in a backyard or illegal garage conversions or just overcrowding an existing dwelling, all of which puts a huge burden on local government.
The next two are very simple economics, I think, and one that Joel Kotkin will touch on as well as when Steve speaks with him a little bit later in the show. Number seven here says, many businesses make decisions on where to locate and invest based on housing costs and the ability to attract qualified employees. The next one, housing costs are determined by supply and demand. A shortage of supply sends prices up, consuming a greater share of household income. I mean, these are kind of back to economics 101 in college.
Right, and I think one of the things that we're underestimating is the brain drain that we're experiencing in Southern California. The other states where millennials can go own homes, raise families, and have a quality of life at a reasonable cost of living is something we need to pay attention to. And if we don't, it's at our own peril. And so the challenge I think we have is this is basic math. This is not complicated. We know what people make. We know what they can afford. We know what kind of quality of life that would entail. And if we can't create environments where people can have an appropriate quality of life, we'll lose the talented ones. And the challenge for our region is going to be attracting and retaining talented people for the future of our economy.
And the last housing principle deals with what we do on a day-to-day basis here at National Core. Well-designed and managed publicly subsidized housing can be a catalyst for transformation in neighborhoods where the economics will not drive new development. And Steve, you see this on a daily basis. How is National Core working to implement this housing principle?
Well, there's always going to be a segment of the population that's going to need help, at least for a season in their life, whether it's homeless veterans, whether it's people with developmental disabilities, whether it's seniors. And so society has the opportunity and obligation to make sure that there's shelter available for those people. How we design it and how we manage it will determine how that the role that shelter plays in the community. And our commitment at National Core is to make sure that our projects are well-designed and well-managed and are an asset to any neighborhood that we're in and actually have a positive impact on the transformation of that neighborhood. And once again, the challenge we have is the perception that we don't want those people living in our neighborhood because there's usually, in many neighborhoods, a problem house where people perceive those people are living. And usually what happens is it's a house that's absentee owned, not being managed, the tenants are not being held accountable, and so that becomes a problem property in a neighborhood and people have a reaction to that. And so one of the things cities should be pushing for is making sure that property owners are taking care of their property, and if people are renting their properties, they're being managed appropriately, and the residents are being held accountable for their actions. And what we're very proud of at National Core is that our city partners are very pleased to have us own and manage properties in their cities.
Coming up next on CoreCast, Steve will be joined by Joel Kotkin, internationally recognized authority on global economic, political, and social trends. We're very proud to have him be a part of this show today. Joel is the Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University in Orange. He's also the executive director of the Houston-based Center for Opportunity Urbanism, the executive editor of the widely read website newgeography.com. He writes in Forbes, Orange County Register, Daily Beast, Real Clear Politics, and he's also the author of seven previously published books, including including an upcoming one that will be published in April, Human City, Urbanism for the Rest of Us.
It gives me a great pleasure to welcome Joel Kotkin to our podcast today. Hello, Joel. How are you?
I'm doing okay.
Good, good. Well, Joel has been a longtime collaborator with me in a variety of ways, trying to make Southern California a better place for people to live and work and come up with principles that are applied far beyond Southern California. And I think it's probably been over 20 years now that Joel and I have been working together, taking on some of the challenges of the region. So, Joel, it's been an honor to work with you, and someday somebody might actually take some of our recommendations and create policy from it. So I look forward to that.
Well, actually, I would say what I'm finding very interesting, and you can look even in the daily press today, there is a growing recognition that there really is a housing crisis in this country, and that we are simply not producing enough housing, not enough of the right kind of housing, and not enough affordable housing. And that is driving all sorts of economic dislocation, corporate relocation, the delay of adulthood among millennials, and is probably the primary force driving our increased inequality, which is now, you know, one of the big drivers of American politics.
Yeah, and it's fascinating to me how, you know, you have to wonder whether it's malicious intent or benign neglect. And my assumption at this point is it's probably a combination of both. You know, the benign neglect side of the equation is I think there are lots of our elected officials that really don't understand the role of housing and the consequences that are not having an adequate supply. And then I think those that are out there that are intentionally trying to stop growth and slow down, you know, the opportunities for people. What's your observation been?
Well, I think there are a combination of things. I mean, one of the issues that came up repeatedly at our meeting recently with a lot of city officials and county officials is, yes, there is a NIMBYism, which, you know, you could certainly, at the most extreme levels, are people who, you know, simply don't want any growth at all. And that's, you know, largely baby boomers and people who already have theirs, if you will. But I think that there are some, I think there are some nuances that I think get missed. One is, I think people who buy into, for instance, a neighborhood at a certain kind of density would like to have some assurance that that won't change dramatically. And I think they have a right to sort of question sort of a densification policy that is, you know, which seems to be aimed at their way of life. On the other hand, there are many ways that we can address some of the housing issues that, for instance, in the affordable housing and multifamily housing realm, by simply taking advantage of space that's now vastly underutilized, malls. Some of them in very bad shape, strip malls that have one or two businesses and the rest are shuttered. There are many areas which already have infrastructure, already are on major streets, already are zoned for commercial that could very well serve as good places for multifamily and frankly could improve the quality of life for the people who live in the single family neighborhoods by providing them with new places to shop, places to walk, places to go to. And certainly, you know, nobody really enjoys an empty mall, I don't think. So I think that there's certainly ways that we can look at this issue without having to say, well, either you're in favor of massive densification of everything, or you're against anything. I think there are reasonable policies. I also think the biggest issue, and I think facing California in many ways, is the fact that the current administration, and this really came out in the discussion, everyone wants to beat up, you know, mom and pop kettle who don't want an apartment with those people nearby, and they're certainly there. But the biggest problem is we have a state administration that's determined to essentially undermine the suburban way of life. Doesn't like single-family homes, wants people who would have been homeowners to become renters, without thinking once of the fact that when you drive relatively affluent people out of home ownership into rental apartments, you're driving up rents at the same time. And I think that this is a big part of it. And frankly, to be blunt, I find most California organizations and business leaders are simply unable or unwilling to address the anti-growth policies of the administration and what those consequences are.
Well, let's kind of take a step back to the report that you've been working on for us. You know, there seems to be, we entitled the report, The Cost
right.
of Not Housing. So
right.
The Cost of Not Housing is built on the myth that housing costs. And
right.
so for a lot of local government, the perception, the overriding belief is that if we add new housing units, it's going to cost more in services than it will generate in revenue. And it seems as though they're not often counting the cost of not having an adequate supply of housing. What were some of your findings as you started thinking about this?
Well, there are several major things. One, of course, is that, and this is something we can see very clearly in the future, as being very much a relevant issue and has already emerged, is the fact that we really have in Southern California and California in general a severe shortage of housing, which is leading to very high housing prices, which leads to companies, and Toyota being an excellent example, but there are many, many other less large examples that you can get into, where, you know, fundamentally we have people who have companies who need middle managers and feel that they cannot provide middle managers with the lifestyle that middle managers historically have had, you know, a single family house in a good district with good schools. I mean, that's pretty simple. Or a nice size apartment that they can either rent or own. So one, you're going to see the eventual movement of industry, including in Silicon Valley, certainly at the mid-level in terms of middle management, but also I think eventually with engineers and even scientists, because they're not going to be able to afford to live in Silicon Valley or Orange County. And then they start making choices and they can go to, you know, places in Texas, Arizona, Nevada, and achieve that kind of lifestyle. So you've got the workforce issue.
That would be like a brain drain, and essentially what we're doing is mortgaging the future of our economy, or we're curtailing the future of our economy, you know, as a result of not providing opportunities for the talent to be able to stay and participate.
Exactly. I mean, we're really seeing, for instance, if you take a look at since 2010, the migration numbers of 25 to 34 college educated, the growth has been much greater in places that are more affordable. And frankly, here in Southern California, the Inland Empire is the only area that really does relatively well in that now, because it's the most affordable area. We have to remember that young people, young families who want to buy a house are going to look at Southern California and say, well, I can't ever afford a house. I'm going to have to either accept living or even a large apartment. I'm going to be forced to really curtail how I live. And of course, it'll make it very difficult to raise a family as well. So I think that one, you're certainly chasing away your potential workforce, particularly as they get into their 30s. And as the millennial generation is now entering their 30s in large numbers, that's going to have ramifications.
The prevailing wisdom was that millennials don't want to own homes. They want to rent apartments for the rest of their lives.
Well, clearly all the survey data will show you that that's not the case. That, you know, millennials do not want to, you know, rent. You know, obviously at a certain point of their lives they rent. Most people rent at some point in their lives. But as they get into their 30s, when you look at the survey data, they want to buy houses or they want to own something. And they want more space, not less. I mean, the problem is that there is this mythology that's been pushed by, you know, certain business interests, but particularly by planners, new urbanists, the Greens. Oh no, young people, you know, they want to live in a shipping crate somewhere, and that's their idea of a great existence. And the fact of the matter is that isn't what's going on. And we are sort of mortgaging our future, particularly when you realize that so many of our homeowners, our existing homeowners, are going to be people who are already in their 50s and in their 60s. And, you know, they're, you know, so essentially as they leave the labor force, there really isn't a good replacement generation for them in an economy like this one, which where the entry into housing is extremely difficult, particularly in the coastal areas.
Right. So on another side of the equation, the shortage of supply drives up prices and it makes it more difficult for entry-level homeowners. But the other thing the shortage of supply does is create overcrowded conditions. What have your observations been about the consequences of the overcrowding that seems to exist in many of our communities?
Well, I think this is one of the things that, you know, obviously there's been some very good research done by Habitat for Humanity, by people who work in a lot of the work I've done in both places like the UK, but also in developing countries. There's no question that highly crowded housing creates many, many issues. It creates health issues. It creates terrible issues for children, and it's likely to create enormous strains on the infrastructure. You know, when you have a single-family home that now has three families living in it, but the pipes and the streets are designed for single-family homes, but they're essentially where they were designed for a family of four, they're now accommodating 10, 12. Well, that's going to put enormous stress on your parking, on your sewers, on your water systems, and frankly, that's going to, you know, create huge problems down the road. But I think the most important thing is what kind of environment are we having the next generation grow up in, if they're growing up in what are very often unsanitary and unsafe conditions. And it's absolutely outrageous that in a country that like this one, which is a wealthy country, in a state like California, which is a very wealthy state in aggregate, that so much of our population is spending 40-50% of their money on rent, and that LA County, for instance, has a overcrowding rate that is five times that of the rest of the country. You know, how people are not outraged by this, I don't understand, and how cities don't understand that if you have an area that was designed for single-family homes, and now because of prices, you have three or four families living in one house, you think that that's not going to create all sorts of law enforcement issues, fire department issues, water issues, sewer issues, and I think people are being very, very short-sighted about what the effects will be down the road and in their cities. And of course, it's also going to create a situation when you have very high, and this is something that we talked about a lot, is sales taxes, kind of the mother's milk of Southern California and California communities ever since Prop 13. And the reality is that if a family is spending 40-50% of their income on rent, they're not going to spend a hell of a lot.
Right. You know, and it is fascinating to me because it doesn't seem to be that complicated, where cities seem to believe that housing demands services when people are what demand services. And if the people are there with inadequate housing, as you just said, they're going to be demanding more services, and you're not getting the tax revenue that would be coming from those additional homes. And then the educational performance of the kids is worse, the cost of health is greater, but you're exceeding design capacity. And anytime you exceed design capacity, you wear it out. And so we're wearing out our neighborhoods and our communities, and it is surprising to me that it's not so obvious to our local leaders.
Well, I think part of it may be somewhat of a generational change. You know, those of us who were baby boomers, you know, grew up at a time of quite a bit of abundance. And when there was a demand for housing, whatever kind of housing it was, multifamily or single family, that demand was fairly quickly responded to. Now, that still happens in states like Texas, and Tennessee and other states where the market still drives things. But in California, the market doesn't drive things, planning drives things. And so what you end up with is a situation where, to a developer, the only thing that makes sense to build is at the high end, because the costs are so high, the regulatory process is so cumbersome, that you simply can't build, you know, let's say, nice, affordable multifamily or $300,000 Levittown type homes, you know, 2,000 square foot homes maybe with a small yard, which would sell like hotcakes. Everybody, right. If you look at the development community, say, oh, I could sell those in a second. The problem is right. There aren't any of those to sell.
Well, and so, you know, one of the opportunities I think that may exist is for those communities that can develop an understanding that being a complete community with housing choices for every life stage, whether it's multifamily, single family, attached, detached, rent, own, will enable that community to attract and retain the talent necessary for the future and the customers necessary for retail. And so one of my hopes is that if we can begin to inspire a new wave of local leaders that want to have successful communities, that we can maybe start seeing some policy changes at the local level. But what recommendations come to mind for you that you think local government should seriously think about?
Well, the sad thing here in California, of course, is that local government is increasingly irrelevant because, you know, basically the state hands out edicts and then you try to accommodate them. And so very often your choices, your menu of choices is very, very limited. I mean, basically, Jerry Brown wants you to build high density near transit stops. And, oh, if you don't like that, you can build high density near transit stops. So you can't build anything else. You know, you're going to have a very hard time building single family. You're going to have a very hard time. Even as one developer told me, he said he wanted to do 10 to an acre single family. And now the state wants 20. Well, you know, you almost can't do that. And, you know, people outside of maybe Santa Monica are not going to pay much, you know, to live in a box in Rancho Cucamonga, as nice as that might be. So I think that, what really has to happen is you have to start to say, look, our primary goal here is to make life better for people. And we're going to make life better for people and do it in an environmentally responsible way that reflects their needs. If your entire housing policy is based on draconian reductions in greenhouse gases well beyond anything that any country is doing, and certainly the rest of the United States is going to do, even under a continued Democratic administration, I don't see how you're going to do that without creating an ever greater scarcity of housing and ever higher prices. I think you have to look at sustainability in not just environmental terms, but in social terms and in economic terms. And unfortunately, in his last years in public office, one assumes, you know, Governor Brown has decided to become kind of a fanatic, and all he cares about is greenhouse gas emissions. And many times his assumptions may be wrong. He doesn't realize that somebody who owns a single family house or rents a large apartment and works out of it has the most environmentally friendly commute of all, which is none. There's no idea of how we can get to where we want to go in a reasonable amount of time and also meet the needs of the society. I mean, ultimately, as much as I think, you know, you might consider the climate change as a important issue, California's being turned into sort of this exemplar doesn't really do anything for the climate. We already are not a very GHG intensive state, and mainly because of our climate, and also because we're just not that big. I mean, we could literally blow up the entire state of California, completely evacuate it, and it would have virtually no effect on GHG globally, because the vast majority of the new GHG is being created in the developing countries. The advanced countries, particularly the United States, have been reducing their GHG over the last 10 to 15 years. So I think that you have to have a more balanced view. And I think if you can't do that, I think municipalities, you know, they can work around the edges, they can build some good projects here and there, but I think it's going to be very difficult. And now the law is such, and if you talk to attorneys, they'll tell you this, that even if you get approvals from the state, and even if the more moderate or, you know, halfway rational environmental groups say, okay, this is okay, let's say like the expansion of Valencia, then you have in the law, whether it's CEQA or in the greenhouse gas laws, you have ways of going to court to block almost anything, no matter how reasonable. And so I think, you know, it's going to be very, very difficult for cities to do much, but I think there are some projects that still can be approved, certainly on the affordable housing side, because you have other allies there who are influential in the Democratic Party, and we do live in a one-party state. You know, it's not just Cuba. California is sort of the same in the sense that one party dominates absolutely everything. And I think you still have some opportunities, and I think cities have to realize, this is an important point, many cities on the coast in particular cannot house their firemen, their police people, their nurses, increasingly their young doctors. And so you're going to have a situation where the people who everybody depends on basically for security, for safety, for health, has to live 50, 70 minutes away from where they work. That's not healthy on any basis.
Right. And you know, you can add teachers and any employees in any of the stores where they shop. And, you know, but it is interesting to think about it. If there's a way we can get a conversation that begins with people matter. Why do we care about this? Because people matter. Why are we doing this? Because people matter. And then begin to think about, you know, of course it's important to have a quality environment because people matter. And so then it becomes a part of a holistic way, or as you said, a balanced way of making sure that we're accommodating the needs of people. And you know, just maybe one last point, because I think this is one that kind of gets things skewed. The vast majority of our population growth are our own children. And so
right.
It's births over deaths within California, which is driving, 80-85% of our population growth. And so we should at least care about our own children and their future.
Well, I mean, and look, how often do you hear, and again, particularly, let's say, a place like Orange County, how often do you hear people say, my children will never be able to live here? When my children get married and start producing grandchildren, I'm going to have to move to wherever they are, Tennessee. I'm going to have to move to Texas. You know, I'll tell you, I fly all over this country, and I can tell you that very often you'll have people, I'm going out to visit my kids in Ohio or my kids in Houston, and, you know, eventually people start to think they move. I mean, we have taken basically urbanist thinking, and this is what my new book is about. Urbanist thinking has removed everyday life and the family and human needs out of the equation in their desire to push a particular urban form for environmental, aesthetic, cultural reasons. And they've taken human beings out of the equation, basically.
Especially children.
Right. And, of course, part of the problem is that many of the people who are pushing these policies, particularly some of the more, let's say, vociferous ones, themselves don't have children. Or are, you know, people who have money, so, you know, they can sort of buy their way out of all these problems. But, we have to understand, Los Angeles County had the largest net decline in children of any major metropolitan area in the United States. I mean, families are not moving to LA. They're not moving to San Francisco. And I think long-term, you know, we're mortgaging, I think as you pointed out, we're mortgaging our future And there are whole sets of, some of it is sort of misguided ideology. Some of it is NIMBY idea. Some of it is driven by greed, because if you restrict the amount of housing that's built, then the housing that you own becomes more valuable. I think there are a series of issues that really, you know, that really afflict this issue. And I think but the basic one is the one exactly what you identified, which is we have taken people out of the entire urban equation. And as a result, we come up with what are very dehumanized ideas about how we build cities and how we need to shape them in the future.
Great. Well, Joel, I want to thank you very much for your time and your continuing work, and let's keep pushing the ball forward and see if we can make a difference.
Thank you to economist Joel Kotkin for joining us today on CoreCast. He is the author of The Cost of Not Housing, the latest national core study published in conjunction with the 2016 Symposium on the Affordability of Housing. You can find that on our website. Joel also is the author of the latest book, The Human City: Urbanism for the Rest of Us, in which he details many of the topics he was talking about today with Steve. And you can pick up a copy of that on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, Indie Bound, or Agate Publishing. Next up on CoreCast, we have Michael Novogradic, who joins us each month with a summary from his Tax Credit Tuesday podcast on the latest happenings in the affordable housing industry.
Hello, I'm Michael Novogradic, the managing partner of Novogradic & Company, LLP. We're a national CPA firm specializing in tax, audit, and consulting services for tax credit-assisted developments, especially multifamily affordable housing. I'm here today to share with you some affordable housing news highlights that were featured over the past month in my weekly Tax Credit Tuesday podcast. If you're ready, let's get started. The Federal Housing Administration comprehensively updated its Multifamily Accelerated Processing, or MAP, guide for the first time since 2011. The new MAP guide combines all FHA multifamily underwriting guidance into one document. Now, the goal is to cut loan application approval times and promote consistency across all HUD processing offices. The updated MAP guide includes revised chapters that discuss the long-term housing tax credit and other tax credits. There's also a separate chapter on master lease structuring to facilitate the use of new markets tax credits and historic tax credits. Requirements of the revised guide are effective May 28th. You can find the new MAP guide at www.hudresourcecenter.com. In other news, HUD announced last week that it's considering making a rule to address over-income tenants in public housing. Currently, public housing agencies are not required to evict households whose incomes rise above the limit for initial admission. However, a recent HUD report found that more than 25,000 families in public housing had incomes exceeding the applicable 2014 admission income limit. Now, to be fair, that's 25,000 families out of 1.1 million in public housing. Still, HUD will pay an estimated $104.4 million in 1 year for over-income families to live in public housing. As you can imagine, the issue of whether to evict over-income families is complicated, and HUD does plan to proceed with caution. On one hand, HUD said that increasing families' incomes is good. Rising income indicates that a family may be on its way to self-sufficiency. On the other hand, HUD also strives to provide scarce affordable housing resources to those who need them the most. So the question is how to determine when a family no longer needs housing assistance. HUD acknowledged that an increase in income may be minimal or temporary, so it should not be the basis for a family to lose housing assistance. However, for families who demonstrate a significant increase in income above the initial limits and for a sustained period, HUD is considering determining circumstances that would require a public housing agency to terminate tenancy or evict an over-income family. Comments on the proposed rulemaking were due March 4th. Well, that brings me to the end of this report. For more tax credit news, tune into our weekly Tax Credit Tuesday podcast. It's available on iTunes and on the Novogratic website at www.novoco.com/podcast. This is Michael Novogratic. Thanks for listening.
Big thank you to Michael Novogratic for his highlights that he provides for us every month on CoreCast from his Tax Credit Tuesday podcast, which you can find at novogratic.com. It's an excellent resource for those in the affordable housing industry, and he always brings us up to date on the latest goings-on there. Well, it's time for the final section of the CoreCast podcast. It's what we learned this week. I will go first, and then we'll let Steve take it away from there. Really a great podcast. We enjoyed having Joel Kotkin on and really enjoyed having him as the keynote speaker at our 2016 Symposium on the Affordability of Housing. What I learned from that was really that there is some local leadership. There are some folks that are taking these issues seriously and are moving the ball forward. We have three mayors in attendance at the symposium: Rusty Bailey, the mayor of the city of Riverside; Dennis Michael, who's the mayor of Rancho Cucamonga and also the current League of California Cities president, as well as Fontana Mayor Aquanetta Warren. And they spoke throughout the symposium event about how housing is crucial to their communities and how they're focusing on that as well, and that they need the support of the community to come to their council meetings, to come to other events in the community and tell them how important housing is. Tell them that we want housing of all sorts, of all types, for everyone in the community, and that they can then take that support and really make things happen in their community. So a really positive symposium and a meeting there, and I think this region, as well as others, are poised for some good steps in the future as it relates to housing. Steve, what did you learn this week?
Well, I think it reinforced the fact that we need to broaden the constituency that advocates for housing. It can't just be housing developers fighting for a project. It needs to be law enforcement, it needs to be health officials, it needs to be retail developers, it needs to be families and communities and people that understand the need for housing for their children, for their grandchildren. And so the forces opposed to the development of housing are getting larger and more sophisticated. The forces that are for people and support people and are interested in making sure people have opportunity and quality of life need to come together in a more coordinated fashion. And so it's my hope we can help facilitate that. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Good job.
Thank you, Steve. And that will do it for this edition of CoreCast. Again, a big thank you to Joel Kotkin and Michael Novogratic for joining us for this month's episode. Head on over to our website at www.nationalcore.org, where you can find all the episodes of CoreCast. And while you're there, head on over to the symposium page and check out Joel Kotkin's latest report, The Cost of Not Housing, done for our 2016 Symposium on the Affordability of Housing. You can also find reports from previous years, case studies, really a lot of good stuff there on housing. So go on over there to www.nationalcore.org and check it out. We'd also love to hear from you. If you have questions or comments, feedback into the show, something you'd like to hear, please send that over to me at jkendrick@nationalcore.org, and we'd love to hear your feedback there. Well, for Steve Pontell and all of us at National Core, this is Jonathan Kendrick saying until next time, take care, and remember, together we transform lives and communities.